Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karmataksam Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Equality, Illusion, and Intention by Lama Adam Berner. The first step toward finding true happiness is to understand suffering. We'll explore how equality, illusion, and intention can be used to increase genuine happiness. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good morning. It's funny, I may be a familiar face to everybody here, but I've never done this in a shrine room in 2 years, so I'm a little nervous. So one thing that's always kind of irked me since I started on the Buddhist path was religion. And I recently found a teaching that really resonated with me about thinking of Buddhism as starting with questions, like science. The idea that we don't come being told what to believe. We come with our own questions. We usually come because something's going on and we need something. And we may not even know exactly what that is. And like science, we may think we know the question that we want to ask. But usually in trying to ask that question, we find maybe another 5 or 10 questions. And in that way, this really is kind of a science of mind more than a religion. Not just at the beginning, but all along the way, particularly when we think we have the answer, there's usually more questions. So the importance of questions and questioning is one of the overarching themes of today. It's our tradition usually to start with saying the prayer of refuge. And we go for refuge because we suffer and because we hurt. And also just because sometimes things aren't quite right. Not all the time, sometimes it's happy. But we know we're going to hurt again. Even in times of great joy and celebration, we know it's only a matter of time until the next change, the next challenge, or the next slip up. We all want to find some kind of lasting happiness, but in spite of ourselves, we make mistakes along the way. And even our best worldly efforts at happiness can bring about discontentment and dissatisfaction in ourselves and in others, even when we have the best intentions. If only we could have a genuine, stable happiness, not dependent on any external factors. A happiness that radiates from within, like a sun, impartially warming, illuminating, and sustaining ourselves and everyone around us. And the Buddha sought this too and met the same fundamental challenges as we do. But he found a way. And this is why we take refuge in him as our example. He didn't invent the way, he found it. And that's why we use the word Dharma. It simply means the truth or the way. The way things are, the way stuff works. It's really that simple. And he found it through searching and questioning and wholeheartedly testing. It took perseverance and it took a lot of challenges, but it worked and it works in the long run and in the near term. And this is why we take refuge in the Dharma, the path that leads to genuine happiness. The Buddha's path, like ours, was not easy. But he never gave up on himself. And he never gave up on his companions on the path, the Sangha. because he knew so well the mistakes they were making, because they'd been his own. And so in the Sangha, the community of enlightened beings, our fellow travelers, we take refuge, knowing they can support us and learn along with us, both as we do the right things and when we forget and have to bring our attention gently back to what really matters. Once again. So let's say the prayer of refuge. Let's do one time in English and then two times in Tibetan. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of the generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. O Sangye Jidan Suki Chodnam La Janchu Padu Dani Kyapsu Chi Dagi Jin Suki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penchir Sangye Drupar Shuk Sangye Chidang Suki Chodnam La Janchu Padu Dani Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin Suki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penchi Sangye Drupar Shu Aden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Dagi Chiwa Pede Denjula Kadun Chenpo Kone Je Sunte Kusun Tukin Yajub Sadu So. Let's take just a couple minutes and do some sitting meditation. I know some of you are already warmed up, others are not. So let's just take just a minute and place your attention gently on the breath. And if you notice a distraction, your mind gets pulled away, just bring your attention gently back to the breath in a friendly way. So we're trying to establish some kind of lasting, genuine happiness. And that's why we meditate. I mean, the thing we're actually doing is familiarizing ourselves with how our mind works. And that's actually what the word means. We translate a Tibetan word, gom, as meditate, but the meaning is actually much closer to familiarize or to habituate. So we want to learn how our experience works and to be fully aware in our experience. Part of the reason why we need to be fully aware is because we think we know how it all works. And we're usually at least a little bit off. So we're really trying to cultivate this awareness to counteract our ignorance. And you may have noticed during the session of meditation, or any session of meditation, a bit of alternation. Sometimes your mind rests on the breath for a little while, or whatever the support is for your meditation. And other times you notice that your mind wanders a bit. And you may note that distraction as thinking, and gently bring your attention back to the support, the breath. Many of us consider the time that our attention is resting on the breath to be the successful time, and a time when we notice we're distracted as some sort of failure. But I'm here to tell you that those moments of noticing your distraction are successes too. In fact, they're the essential moments of success that we really should be grateful for. In fact, it is our awareness of when we've become distracted that helps us to hone our mindfulness and our ability to place the attention stably on the breath. And likewise, our ability to place the attention stably on the breath hones our awareness of when our mind has wandered. These two faculties complement each other. And they're the two faculties that we're cultivating: mindfulness, remembering to apply the technique, and awareness, noticing when we're not. This is the foundational technique of the foundational meditation. It's a process every day. It's a series of adjustments. Hopefully, small adjustments, but sometimes pretty large. And the large adjustments can seem pretty dramatic, maybe even traumatic. We don't generally like that kind of adjustment. We prefer the smaller adjustments. But this requires a keen awareness, the kind of awareness that does not shun or resist noticing a mistake. I thought of a driving analogy recently, thinking of driving on a freeway with the concrete, maybe 3 foot high concrete barriers on the sides, right? When we're driving, there's also painted lines on the road, and we're really good at making these little tiny adjustments to stay right between the painted lines. But imagine if we were slamming into the concrete before we thought to turn the wheel. We don't think about it when we're driving, right? We've learned to make these little adjustments. But here we are in meditation, and meditation is a microcosm of life, right? Here we are in our meditation, making these, you know, getting upset when we find a mistake or realizing we have to turn back a little bit. It's kind of like we treat our meditation in our life like we're slamming into these concrete barriers on the side of the road sometimes and working with all the destruction that comes with that too. But we can meditate more like we drive, hopefully, like most of us drive. So before I get into the main three topics I wanted to talk about today, equality, illusion, and intention, I think it's always good to talk briefly about the Four Noble Truths, because that's the foundational teaching of the Buddha. And he taught that suffering, or really in our language, discontentment, dissatisfaction, is a part of life, that there's a cause for that, and it's attachment, and that if we can abandon the cause, we can achieve the cessation of that suffering, that discontentment, and that there's a path to be relied upon that leads to that outcome. And in terms of the discontentment we're talking about, suffering, the Buddha said we need to understand that. And that's an important point, because generally that's what we try to abandon, is the discontentment or the suffering. So I think there's lots of ways of talking about the Four Noble Truths. And in fact, it's been said that all Dharma is just expositions on the Four Noble Truths. So, but in terms of this talk, I want to point out the idea that there is pain and then there's suffering. And the Buddha himself passed away, and all of his retinue of enlightened beings wept. So we will meet with pain. So we need to develop a little bit of discernment to be able to tell what's stuff that we're just going to meet with and what part of it we're actually creating ourselves, what we have a choice about, you know, and some ability to control. Because there's actually most of it we can control, you know. But we don't usually notice that distinction. And in fact, what we need to do is become more adept at working with those situations that we can't avoid. That's really the path in the short term. We all know about this idea of Buddhahood, but except in some rare cases, that's pretty far way off. So we need to know this long-term goal of where we're going and where we want to go. But what in the short term, what we're doing is becoming more adept at working with these difficult situations that we meet with. That is the path in the short term until we reach, you know, that final goal. So the Buddha said we need to understand suffering. He then said we need to abandon its cause. So that's what we need to abandon, is the attachment. And in the simplest terms, he means attachment to like a self-concept, an idea of like a independent, unchanging self. I am the kind of person who is a good sentence that indicates there's some attachment at work. So we need to work at abandoning the cause of attachment. But understanding suffering will help us spot that attachment better and will help us understand why it's so important for us to let go of it. The Buddha also said that we need to achieve the cessation of suffering, and that's the only thing we need to achieve, is the cessation of that discontentment, that elective suffering. And he said the only thing to rely upon is the path, the Dharma. So three topics I kind of wanted to go over today. The first one is like equality in this context. And the idea here is that we and everyone else want to be happy. That no one wants to suffer. No one wants discontentment or pain or any of this. But when we think we can achieve happiness based on external circumstances, rather than doing the internal work required to abandon attachment, that's wrong thinking. That is itself ignorance. It's not true. And we can see examples of this, like people who have so much prosperity and possessions, and yet they're still angry, bitter people. So we can see that having all the external things in place doesn't actually lead to happiness. Similarly, many of us know people who have unfortunately had a lot of really challenging circumstances in their life and have seemingly met with things they don't deserve. But there are people like that who are incredibly joyful and happy. So there's another reason why we can tell. It's not the external circumstances. It has to be the internal work. And that's why the Buddha said, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. So the idea that we could neglect to transform our habitual patterns of hatred and desire, self-denigration, poverty mentality, etc. If we imagine that we can neglect to transform those and still achieve happiness, that ignores the truth of the matter and ignores the root of ignorance. You know, I maybe everybody else knew that, but like it took me a long time to realize that. Like I just thought ignorance meant you didn't know, but there is a built-in kind of choice there. Like we choose to ignore some stuff. But the Buddha said we are what we think, and we are all equal in that regard. We're also equal in that we all adopt definitions of what happiness is in our methods of avoiding suffering from our groups, our cultural groups, our peer groups, societies, TV, pop culture. It may look different person to person, but we're all getting it from our groups. I didn't say families, but that's a pretty big one too, right? Another thing we all have in common is that distraction is maybe the most common faulty means of achieving happiness. And relaxational meditation is an example. And I don't mean to say that it's a terrible thing, but it's worth pointing out, since there are so many apps and things available now to help you relax. I thought recently of like a broken leg analogy. You know, if you break a leg, you may need a Tylenol for sure. That's gonna help the pain, but it's not gonna fix the problem. It's not gonna fix the break. So we need to be sure when we are doing some sort of distraction, you know, from pain or suffering, instead of understanding it better and abandoning our attachment to needing things to be a certain way, when we distract ourselves like that, we're not actually doing the work that's required to get at the root of the problem. So thinking of this broken leg analogy, you need to put a cast on that thing, right? And you may still want a Tylenol, and that's probably good, and there's a use for that, but ultimately it's the cast that's gonna fix it. Similarly with meditation, doing a kind of meditation where we work with our attachment and we work with getting to know our mind, it's not always pleasant, it's not always relaxing, but that's what gets at the root of the problem. So anything can distract us, or anything that can distract us from our discomfort seems to be a valid means to conquer suffering in the moment, when in fact it's actually a cause for our suffering. So we need to think about that. In the moment, anything that can distract us seems like the way to conquer suffering. But remember, we're looking for this genuine, unchanging kind of happiness, and that's not what leads there. And we rarely realize that these methods of distraction are actually causing further suffering, because they facilitate and perpetuate our attachment. And that's how the cycle of suffering persists. That's what we're talking about when we talk about samsara, the cycle of suffering. So much of our time is devoted to avoiding suffering because of our attachment, which of course causes more suffering. So we need to abandon the attachment in order to transcend the suffering. So understanding that all beings make the same fundamental mistake of avoiding discontentment rather than abandoning attachment is a seed of compassion. Understanding all beings make the same fundamental mistake of avoiding discontentment rather than abandoning attachment is a seed of compassion. I wanted to do a little like three stages of practice thing incorporated in here, where we would do like a contemplation and then a meditation. It's for listening, contemplation, and meditation. But brevity is not my strong suit, and there's so many words in here that I figured I had to cut that out. But we should still try that at home. I would recommend taking some time listening, like letting new information come in, then taking time to contemplate what you've heard, and then just letting it go and meditating. That's really the main point with that, is when it's time to meditate, you let go of the, you don't meditate on the thing you were contemplating, you just meditate. So I'd recommend that at home. So cultivating equanimity naturally counteracts attachment. And this is why, especially in times of conflict, it's even more important for us to understand the suffering we're seeing accurately, and to see that the cause of massive acts of destruction in faraway places and the seemingly minor mistakes and injuries we experience right here at home all stem from the same mistaken approaches to happiness. The same attempts to avoid suffering when we should be relinquishing attachment. And we all make these mistakes. All beings make these mistakes all the time. So turning our attention to illusion, the idea here is we and everyone else are captivated by our illusions. As I said earlier, we tend to think that the way we see the world is how things really are. But the Buddha taught that our view is only relative. We can only see things from our own perspective. You can see that right now. Whatever you're seeing, no one else in the room is seeing. And that's the only way you can ever see the whole world. We're all moving through this world thinking we're getting an idea of the whole thing, but we only ever have our own view. And right now, I'm just talking about your sight. think about the views and experiences and all that too. But another way to think of this is, think of someone you know that you think is actually a pretty great person. And you may know someone else who thinks that person is kind of awful. Maybe you've had really great experiences with this person. They've helped you a lot. Maybe they're your definition of a good person. But then you meet someone who thinks they're just awful, hard to deal with, unreasonable, just not a good person. It's difficult for us when we hear these kinds of things because it highlights that no one from their own side is any of those things. Good, bad, friendly, unfriendly, reasonable, unreasonable are entirely relative concepts. But we constantly think our own projections are the truth. We become fascinated by our relative views, our illusions. It's like when you have a sparkler at 4th of July, you can spin it around in the air, and like a little kid may think it's actually like a ring of fire floating in the air, And we know there's like a stick and a combustible material on it and an arm swinging it around. But it's still kind of delightful, right? Like it's still pretty cool. One that I really love is when there's like a little low wall and somebody does that like fake walking downstairs thing. I love that. Continuously entertaining to me. Another good example is I was thinking about when I was a little kid. My mom had these friends, Beth and Larry, and Larry had this garage door that when you waved at it would open. And I loved it, He would be out there in front of the garage. I would wave, the garage door would open, and it was just the coolest thing. It was one of my favorite parts of going over to Beth and Larry's house. And I was a little kid, obviously, then. But I still clearly remember the day when I was pulling out, we were leaving the driveway, Beth and Larry had gone back inside, and I waved at that garage door, and it didn't open. And I knew in that moment, I kind of knew, right? But I told myself, I'm probably too far away. I'm probably too far away for it to work. And I comforted myself with that and extended the illusion. So recognizing possible untruths in our illusions, we often meet that with making more efforts to believe it. And we believe in our projections because we're enchanted by them. We love to see illusions again and again and again. We love it. Think about if you've ever reread an email or a text that you sent to somebody, particularly in like an emotionally charged state. Or how many times you told the same people the same story about an injury or an injustice you perceived. Particularly if it's the same people you rehash it with over and over again. The more you repeat your illusions, the more you reinforce them, artificially making them seem real. And as they seem more real, they become more intense. We may even hear or see information to the contrary, but because we've become so attached to our illusions, we don't want to accept the proof. And in that way, we act out of ignorance, ignoring the reality of a situation in order to maintain our illusion. And this increases our ignorance, which dulls our awareness. Similarly, we tend to adopt our illusions from our groups. Families, cultural groups, peer groups, societies, television, pop culture. So we have to become better aware of the sources of our illusions and the environments in which they're enhanced or made to seem more real. Because that prevents us from seeing things as they really are. We can easily create these kind of echo chambers in our groups or in our heads, where our illusion seems more and more real. And we all do this. So appreciating our common enchantment with our illusions is a seed of compassion. Appreciating our common enchantment with our illusions is a seed of compassion. And it's always important, but especially in times of conflict, not to cultivate additional wrong views. And those wrong views often lead to a sense that we're different or better than someone because our style of enchantment is maybe slightly different. I couldn't figure out a way to exactly tie this in, but I want to include it because I thought it was a good quote. Trolog Rinpoche said that when the Buddha discovered no self, he also discovered no inherently existent evil, only ignorance of the way things really are. So the last part here, I want to talk about intention. And the idea here being we have to assume good intentions from others. In the core of what I'm about to share with you is the most meaningful teaching I ever got from Kempo Carter Rinpoche, our founder here. My teacher, Lama Kathy's teacher, Lama Tom's teacher, teacher of many people here. And this, I got this teaching from him in retreat. And I have printed out copies. They'll be by the door when you leave. You can have your own copy because this is the kind of teaching that is challenging. And I'm going to lead with that because this is a counterintuitive kind of challenge, a counterintuitive kind of method. But I can tell you I've had 3 or 4 years to work with it, and it is completely transformative. So it's the kind of thing that you take home, try to work on it. You'll meet challenges. Keep coming back to it, you know. So again, the idea here is always to assume good intentions from others. And the way this came up was in retreat, there was a time, it's funny to say, a time where there was some conflict. There was some conflict sometimes in retreat, and this was one of those times. And I noticed this pattern where, let's say like person A does something that hurts person B's feelings, somehow injures person B. If person B thinks person A didn't mean to do it, everyone kind of just moves on. Oh, sorry, okay, you know. But it's in those moments where person B thinks person A meant to do it, that's where the conflict happens. As soon as we don't trust that somebody else had good intentions, then there's a problem, right? And I'd noticed this pattern, and so I wanted to ask Rinpoche about it. Also related to this, I had also been thinking about how, to use another traffic analogy, like if we're driving and someone cuts in front of us dangerously, right? It's like too close, they didn't use their turn signal. I'll only speak for me here, but I know I probably can't be the only one. I'm inclined to think like that person doesn't care about anybody. Like that person only cares about themselves. They're doing these dangerous things, endangering everybody. But sometimes we're in a position where we maybe didn't see a person behind us in our rear view when we're about to get over, or we forget to use our turn signal, or we're running late, you know, and we got to do what we got to do, right? And in those moments, if someone gets mad at us, we think, what? I mean, I'm trying to, you know, sorry, you know, I'm a good person. So I tell that example to highlight the fact that, number one, we can't all be the good people and everybody else is the bad people. But we're predisposed to think that way. You know, we're predisposed to think that we've got the good intentions and other people don't. Or we're right and everybody else is a little bit off, you know. So there's two kind of ideas here. First of all, we're not very good at figuring out other people's intentions or figuring out what's in other people's minds, you know. But then the other question is, like, do we need to, you know? Do we even need to be trying to figure that out? So what I asked Kempo Carter Rinpoche was, I said, is there ever a time to assume others have bad intentions? Or should we always assume good intentions but act carefully? And I'll tell you what he said in a couple pieces here. So he said, best is to think others have good intentions. If you can always do that, it is the best protection from giving rise to kleshas, negative emotions. If you always assume bad intentions, you are self-defeating. And that absolutely blew my mind. Especially the part about, so I'll say it one more time, best is to think others have good intentions. If you can always do that, it's the best protection from giving rise to kleshas. If you always assume bad intentions, you are self-defeating. So first of all, assuming bad intentions justifies our negative emotions. In other words, all our sense of division, separation, conflict, anger, all those things are based on the fact that we've assumed someone else has bad intentions. And Rinpoche said, you defeat yourself by assuming bad intentions. And I want to point out that he said always twice in here. Best is to think others have good intentions. If you can always do that, it's the best protection from giving rise to kleshas. If you always assume bad intentions, you are self-defeating. And I want to quote Lama Mitchell Singletary, one of my retreat brothers, fellow podcast host. And he said this when we were talking about this, and I think it's great. He said, is it naive to think this? We know it's not always true that people's intentions are good. But the point is, that doesn't really matter. It's about what we're doing to ourselves and the world we're living in when we're walking around like that. We don't like the suggestion that we should assume good intentions. We're a little too hardened with all the suffering in the world. But we need to open up to the idea that there's room for us to be a little more simple-minded about things in the positive sense. He said, we're not winning some great battle by being sharp, hard-edged, and complex internally. That's just a recipe for suffering, really. And it doesn't mean that we're becoming stupid. It means that we're choosing to have a simple, positive outlook. And that doesn't suppress intelligence. End quote. So we have these feelings that we not only can know what others think, but we think we need to know what others are thinking. And I think we really need to question both of those assumptions. They're definitely something we've learned from our culture, our family, our groups, but they're simply not true. So Rinpoche said, best is to think others have good intentions. If you can always do that, it's the best protection from giving rise to kleshas. If you always assume bad intentions, you are self-defeating. Then he said, the second best is to remain neutral. All is like the wind, the play of illusion. That's heavy. It reminds me of the all dharmas are like dreams slogan in Lojong. And it hints at this like ultimate truth kind of teaching, right? Like the ultimate state of things. And we do need to get closer to understanding the actual mode of existence of things. We do tend to think of things as like solid and real and independent and unchanging. But in fact, things are impermanent and constantly changing and interdependent. They appear, and yet they're not as solid as we think. It's said they're illusory, like experiences in a dream. Kenpo Rinpoche would often say the best way of doing something, and then share the methods that were acceptable if the best way was not in your means, or if you weren't capable of doing that. But there's something really interesting here, that the ultimate view type of teaching was what he described as the second best way of doing it. There's something really important there. The most profound thing is to assume everyone has positive intentions. The play of illusion is like an ultimate truth teaching, but assuming positive intentions is like uniting the emptiness aspect with awareness imbued with all qualities. It's the expression of Buddhahood. Ultimately, the actual state of realization is positive. It's a positive situation, not just emptiness. And I think this conveys that while emptiness may be the ultimate state of things, we have to bring our view and our conduct into accord with our experience to align the ultimate view with what we see. It's really amazing with a realized teacher like Kenpo Carter Rinpoche that he can convey everything in just like a few sentences. So before I go on, he said, best is to think others have good intentions. If you can always do that, it's the best protection from giving rise to kleshas. If you always assume bad intentions, you are self-defeating. Second best is to remain neutral. All is like the wind, the play of illusion. Then he said, this is how to protect yourself. This is important because not knowing what others' intentions are can make us feel vulnerable. Like, we really think we need to know this stuff to be safe. We need to determine, are the intentions good or bad? And we think our safety depends on it. But Rinpoche made a point of clarifying, this is how you protect yourself. Being in doubt about others' intentions may actually kind of reflect some sort of paranoia on our part. That's just me saying that, you know? Whereas there is just a clarity and a certainty with this perspective of assuming good intentions. It's a way of communicating that what we normally relate to as our relative truth is in its true nature, the lucidity or the clarity aspect of ultimate truth. It's an invitation to relate with relative truth as what it actually is. Rinpoche went on to say, if no negative thought arises in your mind, that is how to protect yourself. Never respond to negative comments or actions. This adds fuel to the fire. It is all about love and compassion. And this last part, I think, refers to when we're on the receiving end of the negative intentions or the negative assumptions about our own intentions. Because it could be kind of quite an ego boost for us to get a teaching like this and think it's all about what we can do about other people. But the fact remains that we're going to be on the receiving end of those types of assumptions, for sure. And we have to remember that even if we know all this stuff about what to do in terms of assuming others' intentions and are able to follow those teachings, there will still be others who accuse us of negative intentions. And this is challenging. So we need to know what to do then as well. And this is why I think he added the part about not responding to negative comments or actions. And it makes me think of two things. First, when someone says something that upsets us and we feel like we really need to respond to them. We probably all know that feeling, right? Like a lot of times you know right what you want to say too. It's a pretty good sign that you probably ought to say nothing. And there's something really important, a practice in there that's really worth thinking about too, is there's very little that needs to be said right away. I mean, other than look out, I don't know what really needs to be said right at the moment you think it. So anything else in a moment of passion that feels like it has to be said should probably be left unsaid. At least let it simmer for a little while. Like, let it kind of roll around. Maybe simmer is the wrong word because it implies heat. But let's say you just kind of let it be for a minute. Maybe you could, anything that you want to say now, you can say later if it's a good idea, you know. Once we've had some time and some space, you know, away from the negativity, a lot of times you'll find that's probably not what you wanted to say anyway. So it's always a smarter way to go, I think. Unless it's lookout, you know, then say it away, but yeah. The second thing this makes me think of, I think this will probably sound familiar to a lot of people, when people begin to tell us how we feel, or when someone's close to us and we think we know how they really feel. So for instance, you may ask your friend or your significant other, are you mad? And they may look mad to you. Maybe you think that whatever the circumstances are ought to be making them mad. So you ask them, you know, are you mad? But they tell you, no, I'm not mad. Maybe we should believe that. But let's examine the situation, right? So first, maybe they're telling us the truth, you know, maybe we're wrong. As we already discussed, we're not the best at figuring out what's going on in other people's minds. And we lean heavily towards thinking our perception is correct and that the others are the ones riddled with negative emotions and confusion and whatnot. So we have to consider that our perception that someone may be in the midst of some strong negative emotions could just be wrong. Also, these kinds of discussions can frequently become self-fulfilling prophecies, right? Conversation goes, are you angry? No, I'm not angry. I think you're angry. No, I'm telling you, I'm not angry. And they usually end in, well, now I'm angry, right? So maybe we just don't go there. But maybe we're right. You know, maybe they really are mad. And why would they tell us they're not? I think that often when we get mad or we get gripped by these strong negative emotions, it's a little embarrassing. We don't want to be there, you know, and we definitely don't want people to have to suffer through them with us. It's painful enough on our insides than to bring it into the outside. So when people make an effort to keep those things in the realm of mind rather than bringing them out through speech and body as well, it may be worth honoring that effort, you know. So there's no need to know what someone else's emotions are. And if anything, you should maybe assume that they are what the person says. That's maybe the best thing you can do for them and for you. So teachings like this, maybe you're 100% on board. Maybe you're already thinking about situations in your life that challenge this idea. If you're not thinking about those things now, you will later for sure. I can tell you that I've been working on this talk and giving it in smaller versions several places over the last few weeks. And I've met some challenging stuff for this in that time, which is actually pretty appropriate, right? Because it helped me dig into this a lot. And anytime there's a teaching like this, first let me say, we said in the beginning, right, that there's an ultimate goal of Buddhahood. And in the short term, we're trying to become more adept at working with challenging situations. So there's an understanding here that we may not be able to do this perfectly. But when you meet with challenges to teachings like this, like my approach is like, all right, well, where's the carve out for this situation, right? And I've tried to find a few of them. I thought about like a temporal carve out. Well, maybe in advance you need to know, because then it would affect your decision. But if it's after the fact, then you can, right? So just in case you land there, the point here that I realized with that is it really isn't about the other person's intentions. It's about being discerning about potential outcomes. And that's separate from people's intentions. Like, we've all been in situations where somebody has great intentions and things go horribly wrong. Or someone has really awful intentions, but it creates an incredible opportunity for us. So contemplate this and look at it in your own life as you move around through the world. Like, I think you're gonna find that always assuming good intentions is the right way to go. And it just makes the world such a better place to be, really, you know? One last story. Five months before the end of my three-year retreat, I was in the three-year retreat from August of 2016 to March of 2020. Got out just in time. And at 5 months before the end of the retreat, 2 weeks before Kenpo Carter Rinpoche passed away, I was really lucky that we had him for 7/8 of our retreat. I remember I was sitting outside in front of the retreat house in the sun, a rare moment of like quiet. Not necessarily a rare moment of quiet, but a rare moment of me just kind of self-indulging. And just thought, like, I probably should ask Kenpo Rinpoche what he wants me to do. Because I came from here to the three-year retreat and was always just planning on coming back here. When you get in retreat, one of the first things they say is, you're not here to be a lama. You're here to practice, you know, and don't think about anything else. And so we all took that to heart. But as it was getting close to the end of retreat, I thought maybe this is time to check in with him, you know? And so I wrote him a letter. He would come to see us frequently. We would have him for lunches and interviews and things like that, a little less frequently than previous retreats because he was into his 90s at that point. Getting around was not as easy. But he was always available to us. We could always write him a note if we had questions, and it was really cool. He took great care of us and all the retreatants. But I wrote him a letter to ask if it was okay for me, if it was his wish for me to come back to KTC to assist Mama Kathy in Columbus. And I also asked if he had any special instructions. And that letter, our retreat master, Lama Sultram Gyaltsen, who's a Western person, an American, a Youper, he took the letter to Rinpoche and did his best to translate for Rinpoche. He's not a fluent Tibetan speaker, but he did his best. And he was able to ask him the first question, you know, is it your wish for Lama Adam to return to KTC to assist Lama Kathy? And he said he was very happy, overjoyed, yes, absolutely, sounds fantastic. But the second question was a little difficult for him to translate. So he gave the letter to Lama Karma Drodal. Lama Karma Drodal, a couple days later, went to him, asked him, you know, is it your wish for Lama Adam to come to KTC? And Rinpoche said, I already answered that letter. And then 2 weeks later, Rinpoche passed away. So I never got those special instructions. But I think I actually did. And I could be quaint and say, it's this teaching I just gave you today, you know, but that's way too simple. I received and am receiving and will continue to receive those instructions through the questions that I ask myself about these teachings. Questions I ask about ultimate truth, the actual mode of existence of things, but more importantly, how to apply and live loving kindness and compassion in every moment. As Rinpoche said, it's all about loving kindness and compassion. And I think as long as we can make that our open question, rather than a steadfast belief, we can continue to approach genuine, unshakable happiness. Questions are the path. So please ask yourself regularly about loving kindness and compassion. That concludes the main portion of the talk. I have a gift that I had commissioned during the 3-year retreat, of course planned to bring it to the completed KTC building in March of 2020. But here it is now. Thank you, Julaine. I commissioned a green Tara Torma. So Max, one of my fellow retreat mates, made this beautiful green Tara Torma. And out of Sculpey and stuff. And we'll put it up here so you can come and look at the end. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. He does great work. So I have to apologize. This is a very fragile piece of work. And in the transport from Carmi Ling back to Columbus, it took a little damage right up here. And I thought, you know, you want to offer the most perfect things to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so I considered not offering it. But it's a little damaged, and so am I. And I offer you both the Torma and myself in that state. But we're going to work on fixing both. So does anyone have any questions? I think there's a mic right there.
Hello?
Hello.
Thank you. First of all, Lama Adam, great to hear you and see you. Okay, I'm gonna summarize what you just said as I understood it, and to see if I did.
Okay.
As far as you know. Okay. We all make projections. That's what the mind does. We're all having assumptions. That's what the mind does. We tend to believe our assumptions are correct. That's what minds do. Since we don't, but there's no way to know for sure, because everything's a projection. So since we're projecting and assuming stuff all over the place, we might as well assume stuff that seems to help people and not harm them. Is that basically what you're saying?
I think that's fair. I think to be specific, like what he said was, this is how you protect yourself.
Yeah.
But the outcome of that is that others benefit too.
Yes. For instance, I've heard it said by people who make arguments slightly different for the existence of God, a belief in the existence of God. And they say, well, what could it hurt? You know, at the very least, we don't know, maybe you don't know for sure, but if you believe that and you act accordingly, life is probably going to be better for you and for others. So it sounds like that's what you're saying. We're sort of stuck not knowing, because that's the limit of the mind. Mm-hmm. Maybe in some ultimate sense, yes, we can search for enlightenment, and then we'll know. But I don't expect that in my life for me. So okay, so we're just doing the best we can and trying to and assuming things that are going to feel that keep us safe and others safe from us, right?
And similarly, so much of Dharma practice is using what we already do. Like when we do like Chenrezig practice and stuff, that's utilizing our discursive mind because it's going to be discursive. So let's put that to good use. Similarly, like we're going to want to think about other people's intentions. So let's do it in the way that's of the most benefit.
Yeah.
Okay. I think you got it.
That's a relief.
Thank you. Anyone else? Well, I will say thank you to everyone. I also want to confess if I had any errors in anything I said today or misrepresentations of any Dharma or anything like that. It's always my goal not to do that, but if that happened, it's my own fault and no one else's. And so thank you, and let's chant the dedication. So we'll do this. One time, both of these, one time in English. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thank you. There's copies of that teaching on the chair on your way out, and feel free to come up and check out this Torma too if you want. It's got some really cool detail work. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.